Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view now through September 22, 2024. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting. It's made possible in part by contributions from podcast listeners. Please consider making a contribution by going to the Donate Now tab at mpbonline.org. Thanks for your financial support.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio, where each week we bring you an in-depth conversation with a creative Mississippian. I'm your host, Lauren Rhodes at the Mississippi Arts Commission, and today I'm talking with memoirist Di Rushing. Di Rushing grew up in the Mississippi Delta. In 1976, she and her husband established the state's first winery near Marigold, Mississippi. A few years later, Di opened Top of the Cellar Tea Room and published a companion cookbook featuring its recipes. In 1990, she and her family relocated to Ouray, Colorado, where she taught high school English for 20 years. Di's new memoir, The Delta in the Rearview Mirror, The Life and Death of Mississippi's First Winery, is her firsthand account of the splendid rise and frightening fall of Winery Rushing. It's memoir, it's also true crime, and it's absolutely gripping. Welcome, Di. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lauren. Happy to be here.
Well, congratulations, first of all, on the book. We're here recording in the studio in Mississippi, and you are on book tour here. What's the book tour been like, holding the book in your hands and getting to see people and read in public?
It's been absolutely wonderful. Holding the book is surreal. I'm going to be honest with you. It's sort of a surreal experience. But see, reconnecting with everybody, I have reconnected with people I haven't seen in 50 years, from old teachers to old next-door neighbors, even an old boyfriend or two has shown up at the signing. So it's been just absolutely a wonderful experience.
Have you been up to the Delta yet?
Yes. Okay. That's where we started. We started in Cleveland, Mississippi, which is the closest town to Marigold, did signings there, we're on Thacker Mountain Radio, which was a real wonderful experience.
Yeah.
And then we did signings there and also down to Greenville at the Indigo Gallery, where I saw a lot of the old neighbors and friends from way back in the 60s and 70s. So it's been a very gratifying experience all the way around.
Oh, that's great to hear. And University of Mississippi Press is your University Press of Mississippi is your publisher. Did you know that you wanted to publish this book with them? I mean, they're such a fabulous press.
That was really very much just a stroke of luck. When I started writing this book, what kind of started me on the book was I went up to the attic to clean out the attic. This was during COVID, and I was just sitting around eating out of boredom, getting fat, wasn't interested in making bread or watching Tiger King, so I had to find something else to do. So I went up with the mission to clean out the attic, and when I got up there, I knew they were there. It wasn't that I just hadn't seen them in probably 20 years. Box upon box of old newspaper articles, magazine articles, the awards that our wines won over the years. And I started looking through it. And my first thought was, you know, I really need to make sense of this for my kids and my grandkids, because they had always heard, you know, bits and pieces of it. But I never had really collated it into a chronological, something that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the newspaper articles were about our growth, and they were just beautifully written. And then one whole box was about the break-in, which is what forced our leaving in 1990. But every chapter I start with a newspaper article where I take an excerpt and put it in verbatim, and then I kind of expand on that. So it's newspaper articles from all over Mississippi, all over the Mid-South, and even one or two from the West Coast. So it was, as I read the articles, it would jog memories, and that's how the book came about. To answer your question, after I had started on the book, I had my friends and my daughter, who's in Switzerland, said, "Mama, I think you really need to do something with this. I think this has a broader appeal than just your grandchildren."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, yeah, but, you know, I've never thought of myself as a writer in any way. I mean, I'd never had that aspiration to be a writer at all. And so I said, well, maybe. And so I talked to a couple of friends, and they said, well, I think a really good fit would be University Press of Mississippi. Of course, I had many books that they had published.
Yeah.
I just didn't think I was that highfalutin that I would be able to get published by University Press of Mississippi. Sent it off, and they jumped on it immediately. I never even sent it anywhere else. Never sent a draft anywhere else. They jumped on it, and they have just held my hand through this whole process because everything I do is new and exciting. And I'm 71 years old, but I feel like I'm just starting a new career, you know, very short-lived, I'm sure, but an exciting one.
Well, that is so exciting. And I do want to talk to you more about the newspaper articles, but maybe before we get too far into our conversation, you can read to us from the book.
Sure. I'd be glad to. The book is part chronological and it's part flashback. There's a lot about what happened, which, as I said, forced our leaving. But there's also a lot about the history of the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
When I set out to write this book, I wanted it to be very honest, very authentic. I write a great deal about my feelings. The whole book is written from first person point of view. And so I really wanted to be authentic. That was my number one goal. Some of the things I talk about are flattering to me, some not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I was honest. One of the things that I remembered very vividly as I was looking at the articles and thinking back to the memories that they jogged was how I felt at the top of the stairs of the wine cellar when we were first learning about the break-in. This would have been on May 4th, 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my children, who at the time were 6 and 8 years old, very young. I just rushed them out of the house because I had heard just kind of over the phone Sam talking to someone about the wine going down the drain, and I didn't know what he was talking about. So I'm going to read the part of when I first arrived at the winery with the kids, and Sam had already been there for a few minutes. I think at that moment, as Sam and I held our children in a huddle at the top of the stairs, all four of us knew on varying levels that our lives were forever changed, that the mostly charmed existence we had enjoyed before this moment would be altered in some inconceivable way. We loved our routine, the comfortable mundane cycle of work, play, and school, and I felt certain that this lifestyle was somehow coming to an end. In retrospect, I see that it was at this precise moment that I internalized the truth that any control we may think we have is an illusion, a trick played on our minds to keep us reasonably sane as we navigate life. The realization was paralyzing. So that was kind of how I felt, and it was so true.
Mm-hmm.
After that, we went over to the tea room. The winery was by far the most expensive loss that we had because this young man who was a disgruntled employee, we had fired him a few weeks before because we learned that he was selling drugs in the parking lot mm-hmm. on the weekends. So obviously we fired him, didn't report him. We couldn't prove anything. And then a few weeks after that is when he came in, broke into the winery, went down to the wine cellar, opened all of our huge stainless steel vats, and released 8,000 gallons of wine, which was our entire livelihood.
Oh my God.
Then he went over to the tea room where he took a hammer and broke every pane of glass that was in the tea room, busted up a lot of the pottery and the glasses, turned over chairs, knocked over everything. And I was going to read a little excerpt from that experience as well, which is just the page after the one I just read. We stepped onto the front porch. The placard by the front door, top of the cellar tea room, was broken in two and thrown onto a wicker chair by the entrance. The blue French door was demolished, sharp shards of glass protruding from each frame. The sound of running water grew louder, and the ominous odor of propane wafted from inside. I peered through a broken pane in the door. Tables were overturned, and chairs sat at obscene angles among them. Blue and white sugar bowls and salt shakers lay in fragments, scattered on the floor. The hand-carved easel holding a chalkboard featuring the previous day's menu stood absurdly intact, witness to the night's devastation. The doors leading to the screened porch overlooking the Sunflower River were half off their hinges, and the cash box lay nearby on its side, open and empty, save for a few coins. Taking my children's hands once again, I stepped away from the porch and led them back toward the parking lot in front of the winery. We sat silently on the bench, waiting for Mary Beth to pick them up for school. We looked across the bayou and observed dust billowing in the wake of Jack's red tractor as he drove a turn row in the vineyard. We listened as a crop duster flew low overhead, headed towards our neighbor's farm to the west. Lizzie inched closer to me, smoothing out the wrinkles in her dress, a solemn look on her face. I held Matt's small hand in mine as he counted the few cars that sped past on the road. I was grateful that my children were well on their way to school by the time the sheriff's car pulled up in front of the winery, red and blue lights flashing under an impossibly blue Delta sky.
Wow. I read the book, but just hearing you reread that moment is extremely powerful and disturbing. You describe that scene in so much detail, that moment of realizing that your livelihoods had literally gone down the drain. What did you have to go back and look at photos, or was that scene just seared in your memory?
This scene was seared in my memory. Mm-hmm. The articles and the photographs jogged my memory, as I said, and helped me remember these things. But I remember very clearly having the sensation that our life is not ever going to be the same again. I had no idea to what extent that mm-hmm. was true. And actually, I didn't know that for the next until 9 months later when he came back with a roar once again into our lives. And that's when we decided we had to leave.
Right. Well, and you didn't know at first who had, I mean, you didn't know who had done it at first.
That's correct.
Yes. Yeah.
We assumed it, that it was someone who knew us simply because of the sheriff's questioning. He would say things like, who's mad at you? You know, obviously this isn't a random prank type thing. This is someone who knew what he was doing to destroy your livelihood. And it didn't take long for us to realize it was probably the man who was accused of it, Ray Russell. He had, as I said, we had fired him, and he definitely had a vendetta against us that no one else we could think of would have done that. So the sheriff immediately went to their house, where he found the wine-soaked blue jeans in his living room. But the most disturbing thing he found, and this is really disturbing to a lot of people for different reasons, is when they searched his bedroom, they found in his top dresser drawer 4 dog collars of dogs of ours that had been killed or gone missing, that he had killed or stolen, killed, and kept the dog collars as mementos. Unfortunately, there were 2 more to come after that as we were trying to piece things back together. It was actually the killing of our black lab, Sassy, that was the final straw for us to leave.
I'm so sorry. I mean, I know it was long ago, but just reading those moments, too, it's really heart-wrenching to hear.
Hi, I'm Lauren Rhodes. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. The Arts Hour is a co-production of the Mississippi Arts Commission and MPB Think Radio. You can also listen to the show on Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app.
Do you drive a vehicle? Then you'll find autocorrect helpful, especially on Coach Charlie's Tip of the Week. Listen to our podcast with me, Coach Charlie Melton, on any podcasting platform or on the MPB Public Media app.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio. I'm Lauren Rhodes at the Mississippi Arts Commission, and today I'm talking with author Di Rushing about her memoir, The Delta in the Rearview Mirror. So I'd like to go back in time to some of the happier moments you describe in the book about the founding of the winery. What made you guys want to open a winery in the Delta?
Well, my husband and I graduated from Mississippi State in 1976. I was an English major, and he was a soil science and chemistry major. So we came back to the family farm that had belonged to his grandfather near Marigold, between Marigold and Drew, with the intention of just doing your traditional crops, you know, the rice and soybeans, mm-hmm. a little cotton back then. But that was about the time that, farms were becoming very large corporate-type operations.
Right.
And Sam said, well, we can either farm small and stay poor, or we can do something else. Well, I told him I didn't want to be poor. That was not an option as far as I was concerned. So I said, so we started looking at other things. He had made a lot of friends with some people at the enology department at Mississippi State, which was when that started.
Okay.
It was, I think, a year or two before. And they were extremely supportive with not only the wine making process, but also the growing of the vineyard. We have had a 30-acre vineyard. They were very helpful with that too. And we just kind of bounced our, we didn't do anything the first year from 76 to 77 with the farm, really. Mm-hmm. Sam had a soil testing business, and I was working at Delta State at that time, Delta State College, in one of the offices there. And so we kind of bounced around a lot of ideas, and that looked like the best bang for the acreage that we had, because you can grow a lot of grapes on 30 acres of vineyard. And so we looked into it, got the equipment in. I still had to work at Delta State for a few years till we got on our feet. Started the winery. Just a few years after that, we started winning some national awards, which we were very proud of.
Yeah.
And then in 1983, which was between my two children, one was born in 81 and one in 84, I opened Top of the Cellar Tea Room, where I featured dishes made with wine. I just had two seatings a day. It was very popular, reservation only. I just had two choices every day of things to eat. And, you know, one thing I learned real quickly, people do better when they don't have a lot of choices.
Yes.
I mean, you go in a restaurant with a 20-page menu and you're lost. You go with there four things and you can figure it out real quickly. So,
and you had a small kitchen, too.
Yes. Oh, yeah, it was 8 by 10.
Oh, my gosh.
And speaking of the kitchen, that was the heart of the tea room. I had two employees who worked in the kitchen the whole time, one of whom is still working in the tea room owned by McCarty's Pottery.
Wow. She
was hired as soon as we quit, which was 33 years ago, as soon as we left. And I went to visit her last week, and I said, Essie, how are things going? She said she just couldn't believe that I had come back, and
I gave her
a book. She is called Flo in the book because I changed a lot of the names, but her real name is Essie, and she was just so, it was just so good to see her. Unfortunately, the other one has passed away. And then Shelley, the waitress who was with me out front, I saw her, and we had a great visit, Shelley Scarborough Tibbs. And so that was the heart mm-hmm. of the tea room, and we would just get in there and have so much fun. And, of course, the clientele, the customers. We had a lot of older, retired people mm-hmm. that would eat there, and some of them had standing reservations same time every week for 7 years, eight years. So it was pretty, it was a wonderful, happy, happy time.
Well, and I loved reading about the family-owned business aspects too, like a customer finding a baby sock laundered in a napkin. That was just such a sweet detail, and you know, you were embarrassed, but she loved it.
She just loved it. I was embarrassed but I would wash the linen napkins, of course, sometimes there would be a sock in the dryer, and unfortunately one got folded up in a napkin, and it was a good customer, thankfully.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, when I was reading it, I was like, man, I've never heard of a wine muffin, but yeah. Reading about it was making me very hungry.
I know. They were good. And I made that recipe up. Unfortunately, I don't remember. I think I can reproduce it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one of those things we did every day, and so I just never wrote it down.
Right.
But I am going to, and it's not even in my cookbook, which I wrote in 1990. That was one of the things I was doing in that interim, that 9-month interim between the break-in and the time we left, was trying to get back on our feet. So I wrote the cookbook, and it sold 6,000 copies in 6 months.
That's incredible.
Unfortunately, we were closed 6 weeks after it came out, so most of those were you know, long distance or bookstores here in Mississippi who carried it. And the question I'm asked the most is, are you going to reprint that cookbook? And the answer is yes. That's my project for this summer. And this time I'm going to put the wine muffin recipe will be in there. That's the only one that wasn't in the last one. So I've got to do a little experimenting when I get back to Uray and figure it out. But I know I can do it. The only liquid is wine. That's the only liquid in the
Okay, butter. I wasn't sure if it was actual wine or like the dregs of the grapes.
No, it's real wine.
Okay.
And it's fun because you can put a sweet wine and get a sweet muffin, or you can put a drier wine. And it's more like something you would eat with the dinner, you know, more like a roll. So it's,
oh, interesting.
It's fun.
Yeah. So had Sam grown grapes, your husband, had he grown grapes at all or had any experience growing crops before?
Not really, because we were so young. We were just 22 when we started the winery. So he had grown, you know, he and his grandfather had fooled around out on the farm growing muscadines a little bit, but it was mostly a vegetable garden that they did. Yes, he was very familiar with how to grow things, for sure. And I found real quickly that that was not my thing because I got hot and I didn't want to go back inside. So I wasn't much help in the vineyard at all.
Well, there's a wonderful moment in the book where you reveal that Sam, your husband's cousin, is Felder Rushing.
Yes.
And Felder kind of criticizes your gardening skills a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
We just had lunch with Felder an hour ago, and he told me one time when we were sitting on the porch, this was in 77, I guess, "Di, you're a planter. You're not a gardener." And I said, "What's the difference?" He said, "You like to plant them, and then you like to forget about them." And I remember looking around the yard, and everything was just as dead as it could be, and this was in the middle of summer. I said, "Yeah, I think you're right."
Well, in telling this story, you know, you talked a little bit about how your memory was jogged by some of these articles, the newspaper clippings that you had saved and kept in your attic. And I just want to read one of them because it's just such a delightful article. Some of these, like the way that the journalists were writing, was it makes me long for the days of local papers. "The winery Rushing, located 3 miles east of Marigold, north of Cleveland, has mixed European processes with redneck intuition, producing the first commercial wine in the state since Prohibition." What was it like having all of these newspapers just, you know, writing about you guys all the time?
It was pretty sexy at first. We kind of liked the attention. I ain't gonna lie about that. It was fun. And they were always just so kind, Lauren. Mm-hmm. We never had a sense of a gotcha moment at all. They were always just very kind, and they wanted to portray it in a positive light. They were very, very interested in being accurate with everything, which we always appreciated that. They often got the human interest element down just right. We had some really fine journalists who visited our place. Rita Grimsley Johnson of Memphis, she went on to just become a very famous writer, and she did a couple of articles on us while we were there. So it was wonderful. Like I said, we kind of liked the attention. I'm not going to pretend like we didn't.
Well, and you were doing something really interesting. I mean, it was the first commercial winery, which you kind of had to go through some hurdles to even get license, from what I understand.
We did. Getting the license was that helped us with knowing the Mississippi State Associates. They were very instrumental in helping us secure Mississippi Winery Number 1, which was our designation. The hard part came later when Sam was working real hard to get the appellation of origin for the Mississippi Delta. In the wine industry, that means that your area has been recognized as an official viticultural area or wine grape growing area.
Yeah.
And it's still the Mississippi Delta from in the plat that Sam spent many years getting straight is still the second largest in the United States today.
Oh, wow.
And so somebody could go in anywhere in that region and start a winery, and it would be an official designated appellation of origin, like Burgundy or Bordeaux. Those are areas of France, and the Mississippi Delta is an official wine-growing area, but no one has picked it up
since
then.
No one has picked it up. That was going to be one of my questions, and no one has called you guys being like, "Hey, tell me your secrets."
I think that after they saw what happened to us, they're not that interested in it. So I don't know. But they haven't, and it's a shame.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's still there, that that Appalachian of origin.
Yes.
One of the characters that I really loved in this book was Big Tom.
Yes.
Who was Sam's grandfather. And he just seemed like he had the best stories, the most interesting life. Can you talk about Big Tom and what his role was maybe in your life and also in the book, too?
Yes. He played a very big role in our life. Big Tom was a middle child of 15 that was born down in Tylertown, Mississippi. And when the boll weevils hit, the family took the younger eight to the Delta to try over again, and the older eight stayed down in Tylertown. So we're still related to all the Rushings down in the Tylertown area. And when he came up, he was like all young people. He just kind of went from place to place looking for a place to work. His most interesting job was he was hired to empty the nickels out of all the jukeboxes in the Delta. And he became really good friends with a lot of the blues players, especially Charlie Patton. He became very good friends with Charlie Patton. As a matter of fact, Charlie Patton has written a song about him called The Tom Rushen Blues. It's misspelled. It's R-U-S-H-E-N instead of I-N-G. But he was talking about the Big Tom one time. Had to put him in jail for disturbing the peace. And then Big Tom, another interesting thing was he was one of the deputy sheriffs that had to keep the people on the levee during the flood of 1927. He had to hold them at gunpoint so that they wouldn't leave and immigrate north. Some really sad stories that he had to tell, but he was just a wonderful man and our biggest cheerleader for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of that history that you mentioned during the Great Flood of 1927, I mean, you don't shy away from some of the darker moments in history in the Delta and some of the more violent histories, too. Was that something going into the book, writing it, that you knew you needed to include?
Yes, it is. Not that I'm an expert on any of that. I don't pretend to be. But I know what the stories were. I know how I felt about them at the time, which was entertaining. And now I know how I feel about them now, which is just unspeakable horror.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the flood of 27, but I grew up in Greenville, Mississippi. I was a senior when the federal government forced desegregation. And many of our students immediately fled to private schools. I did not, and I am so glad that I didn't, because I made a lot of friends, learned a lot that year.
Mm-hmm.
And two of my friends who are Black, who are featured prominently in my book, Janice Moore and Iris McGee, still live in Greenville, or they've come back to Greenville, I should say. And they were at my signing in Greenville last week. They're still very dear friends. They've been out to see us in Colorado. I have a lot to thank them for the insight that you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I was writing the book, I would be on the phone saying, what was going on in your head when all this was going on? And the things they came up with were quite illuminating, things I had never thought of, which is pretty much the problem.
Well, and I think, you mentioned earlier that you wanted to tell an honest story, and that means not always portraying yourself in the best light and being honest about your flaws, which I think makes for a more interesting book. No one wants to read a memoir that's, just a tale of conquest. So was that hard, though, to kind of reflect on maybe some of the ways your mindset has shifted, or things that your friends told you that made you think about growing up during that time frame differently?
Well, it wasn't hard in the way that it made me shift my thinking, because I'm proud of the way I've shifted my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It made me ashamed of things I've done in the past, for sure.
Hi, I'm Lauren Rhodes. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. The Arts Hour is a co-production of the Mississippi Arts Commission and MPB Think Radio. You can also listen to the show on Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app.
I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, host of the original Southern Remedy, the show where I answer your medical questions. Subscribe to the podcast by searching for Southern Remedy on any podcasting app.
You're listening to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio. I'm Lauren Rhodes with the Mississippi Arts Commission, and I'm talking with writer and former co-owner of Mississippi's first commercial winery, Di Rushing. So I'm curious, how long did this book take you to write?
I wish I could say that I just sat down and started writing and I was just so enthralled with myself I couldn't stop, but that would be untrue. I would pick it up for a little while and write and put it down, sometimes for a month or two, then pick it up again and write a little more and put it down. And then as I got closer to the end, I was a little bit more dedicated than that. Overall, I would say it took me about a year and a half to from beginning to end. But what was surprising was when I was finished, I knew I was finished. And it was odd. I didn't think I would ever have that feeling that I would be finished with the book.
Yeah.
But I was, and I knew it, and I haven't really rethought anything, which is totally out of character for me. I'm one of these that second-guesses herself all the time, but I knew when I was finished, which was surprising.
And what was that feeling like? Was it relief, joy?
A little bit of both.
Yeah. Yeah.
More, and a little sadness, too, to be honest, because I love the writing process. I taught English. The writing was the easiest part. The vocabulary, the syntax, all of that was the easiest part because it's just what I've graded papers for 20 years of high school seniors, you know, and I've always been a huge reader, of course. So I just that was the easy part. So I immediately started writing my second book and I have finished it now. And it's the same thing. I knew when I was finished.
Wow.
It was finished. And it's also set in the Delta, but it's fiction.
It's fiction.
It's called Who You Love.
Well, you make this sound so infuriatingly easy. Like
it's not. I mean,
it's not that easy.
we'll see how the second one is. I was very lucky the first time, and no one knows that better than I do. The second time, UPM does not do fiction, so I imagine I'm in store for a lot of rejection with this next one because of the process, and I'm well aware of that. And it's not like I'm trying to start a new career. If it doesn't go anywhere, that's fine too. But it was fun to write it, and it's a fun book.
Well, and I just imagine these stories that are in your memoir are things you've been thinking about, you know, for many years. So it was just ready to come out into the world.
It was.
You know, you mentioned there's a lot of chronological back and forth and some flashbacks. Was that how you wrote the book originally, or did you incorporate that style as in the revisions? Because the way you tell the story with the flashbacks is so compelling in building suspense.
Yes.
Which is what makes this memoir feel like, I mean, it is true crime, but you feel like you're reading a thriller in some places.
Right. No, I think I really did the flashbacks as I was writing the chronology for the most part, because I would think, you know, I'd be talking something about Big Tom, and I think, you know, he had some interesting things. So I would go back because I would always bring it back in the first half of the book to the sheriff looking around the winery and coming to conclusions and the investigation. And then that summer when Ray was stalking me on the road every day. And I was very, very frightened of that. So it would kind of go back and forth a little, I would say, more naturally than most people would think.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about that summer. I mean, I don't want to give too much away for those who are going to read this book, which I highly, highly recommend.
Thank you.
You should. But that summer just felt, you know, after the events that you described with the wine pouring into the river, the destruction of the tea room, just so filled with fear.
Yes.
for your safety and for your family. What was that like for you guys?
Well, it was terrifying. I would pull out to go to town to get groceries or something or go pick the kids up from school. And see, the problem was he lived right across the river from us. We could hear the goings on at his house from our front porch. Mm-hmm. So he was very close in proximity. And so he would stay right at the bridge and wait for me to come out, which was on a 3-mile stretch with one house on the whole 3 miles. And then he would pull in front of me and terrorize me. That continued on into the fall. And then as we got closer to the trial, we were all, you know, everybody in the Delta thought, this is a slam dunk. There's no way this guy's. He confessed.
He had wine-soaked pants.
Yeah, and he confessed to doing it. What he never confessed to, and his lawyers were very sharp, was the loss of $401, which was nothing in comparison, that he had taken that night at the winery. He took that, and they could never prove that he took that. And that was really the only charge against him. But what the trial really boiled down to, and a lot, some of it may be my fault, I don't know. I went into the trial wearing my grandma's pearls and my new dress and my high heels, just sure it was a slam dunk, not worried about anything. But it turned out that the jury was looking more at the haves versus the have-nots. And they were, for the most part, the have-nots. And they were able to identify with his narrative. They portrayed us. They even brought in civil rights comparisons of Medgar Evers and Fannie Lou Hamer about how mistreated he had been because he grew up in the, you know, so, and this, these were all white people I'm talking about.
He was a white man.
Including Ray. This is not a, but it was just the stuff that they pulled out. And it worked, I guess, because they came back the next day not guilty, and he just started in all over again. So 2 weeks later, we were driving to Memphis, and we had just found our last puppy shot through the heart, our black lab, Sassy. He was stuffed in the garbage can. She was stuffed in the garbage can. And that's where we were driving to Memphis. And it was so funny because we had just passed that place in Clarksdale, the crossroads, where Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil so he could play a mean guitar. And so we had just crossed that. And I said, we're moving. And Sam said, what? And I said, we're moving. And he said, where? I said, we're going to move to Colorado. And that was just the farthest place I could think of that at that moment, you know. And so he said, okay. So 2 weeks later, we were gone. And starting all over with not a penny to our name, because our insurance covered nothing that happened.
Oh,
and the farm wasn't in our name. Nothing was in our name.
So you couldn't sell the farm?
No. We couldn't sell our house, the tea room, the winery, anything. It was all part of the family. So,
what made you say Colorado in that, other than it being far away?
We had vacationed
there. Okay.
We had camped in Durango a lot, and we had skied in Telluride a lot. So, but really, I don't know. I don't know why, but it's worked out. We left a lot of love here, but we found a lot of love in Colorado, too.
Mm-hmm. You know, that moment where you just have this kind of divine intervention almost that you have to leave. Do you think if Ray had gone to prison, you would have tried to restore the winery?
Oh, there's no doubt we would have.
Okay.
But he wouldn't have gone for long, you know, because he would have gone probably for 3 or 4 years. But absolutely, we would have, because we would have just been denying the reality. But he had cousins and his father, they were all of the same ilk. I'm glad it turned out the way it did. I think we would have just postponed the inevitable.
Right.
We were running for our lives when we left. I can't stand drama queens. I taught high school for 20 years. Can't stand them. But we were running for our lives when we left the Delta.
Well, and you had two young children at the time. And they had already found one of their precious dogs. They had found two of them. And that's absolutely scarring.
Yes.
So, I mean, reading the book, I was like, yeah, they had absolutely no other option but to leave. Can you talk about some of the community's reaction to you guys, to your decision to leave? Because it was a lot of mixed reactions.
It was funny because we got letters, and some of the little old ladies were just violent, like, you need to do this. But even they said, but I know you have to leave. They all said, we hate this. You know, what can we do? But they would always conclude, you can't stay either because they knew what we were up against. And now it's interesting coming back with the book tour here. It's been real interesting because I've had people just break down in tears because they said, we just weren't there for you. And I say, yeah, you were. You were there for us. You may not remember it, but you were there for us. And but it was just out of our hands at that point. It was out of our hands. And we even had offers from a hitman, several hitmen.
Oh my gosh.
Who would one of them on Christmas, that last Christmas Eve. And he said, you know, he called and he said, I can take care of this, you know. And we, no, you can't do that because he said, you know, some people just need killing, you know, the time. And I went, no, I don't think that's true. I think there are some less violent options. But they were very sincere. He sounded kind of like he was looking forward to it, to tell you the truth. Oh, and so, but it's been a very interesting time. I'm really glad in a lot of ways that we've had a lot of adversity, and it didn't end when we got to Colorado. We really struggled to get back on our feet financially. Thankfully, I had a teaching certificate. That's what saved us the first few years. That plus Lee and Pup McCarty sent us $10,000 of pottery that first summer to sell in our shop, and they said, you never have to pay us for this. We just had one thing after another that occurred like that. So I think I'm a better person for having, you know, we all know people who have kind of slid through life with no problems, no adversity, no nothing more than their hairdresser retired, mm-hmm. you know, and then you have people, and I fall in the middle there, you know, you have people who have lost a lot of loved ones, and I think sometimes it leaves us a better person.
Yeah, well, you reflect on your experiences in such a meaningful and powerful way. Can you talk a little bit about those early days in URA and Sam's decision to open up a glass? Well, did he open up a glass blowing shop?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Right away. He did. He had for the past year or so, he had learned how to blow glass from Susan Ford, who was a Jackson glass blower. She really kind of took him under his wing and showed him some things. So he always wanted to do that. So when we got out there, that was the first thing we did. I've been married to Sam 51 years, and he's never had an idea that was, you know, sane, I guess,
for lack of a better word. Artist or entrepreneur.
Yeah, exactly. He's always had these strange things he wanted to do. So, you know, and in the early days, I don't know. We were welcomed in URA for sure. I wasn't sure how they would have a take to an English teacher, high school English teacher, with my accent. But, you know, I never really lost my accent. My students loved it, and they minded me. They were, here I am 5'1", and they were just scared to death. I'm not scared, but they were very respectful. And that was really, so I was, like I said, we left a lot of love, but we found a lot of love, and we've had a wonderful life there the last 34 years, and our children were raised there, and that's home now.
It's a happy ending.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very happy ending.
Well, in our last couple minutes, what was your favorite part of the book to write, and what was the hardest part for you to write?
Let me see. My favorite part for sure was writing about the tea room, mm-hmm. and how much fun that was because I have such wonderful memories and my customers were so easy. The hardest part to write about was the triple murder at the end, which is what happened to the guy who did all this to us. I was very pleased that I did not take any joy from learning of his terrible demise. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of proud of that, the Schadenfreude part, you know, the lack of Schadenfreude. And so that was, even that was good. But I will say that it wasn't until I learned of his death, which was only 8 years ago, that I realized that I was still, part of me was still a little bit afraid that he would come back and find us. Because when I learned of that, I could feel this little tiny sliver of fear flying out of my head and a sense of peace that I hadn't had since this happened in 1990. And that was surprising. I thought I had worked through it completely, but I didn't. I had not.
Well, that's why I feel like the title is so appropriate to the Delta in the Rearview Mirror. You know, it was something that you kept with you for a very, very long time, still with you today.
Yes.
Well, Die Rushing, your book is so beautiful. I hope everybody gets their own copy of The Delta in the Rearview Mirror, The Life and Death of Mississippi's First Winery. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB depends on support from listeners, so if you can, please contribute today at mpbonline.org.
What is Chalkboard Chat? It's an MPB education podcast. It's a variety show providing information and resources for teachers, students, parents, guardians, and everyday people on various topics. It's learning something new with every publication. Chalkboard Chat. Find the podcast or listen from chalkboardchat.mpbonline.org.